And welcome to Bitches on Comics. I'm your host, S.E. Fleenor, and I am super delighted to be here today with another of our hosts and my good buddy.
Oh, my name is Sarah Century.
Hey, Sarah.
It's very cold where I'm at. Being cold means that it takes you longer to think. And so I forgot what my name was for a hot second. Welcome to...
And why is it so cold, Sarah? Because you refuse to turn the
because
heater
Because I'm
on.
Thermostat dad, and I'm just like, no, don't touch the thermostat. It's where it needs to be. Unless you're paying the heating bill, you don't touch that thermostat dial. And my pets just look at me quizzically like, we have fur, girl. Like, you're the one...
You're the one
that's
cold.
And I'm just like, we won't be heating this place. What are you trying to do? Heat the indoors? Anyway. Yeah. Oh, yeah. So.
I love it.
Just had a moment where I was just like, let's just talk about this for the next 20 minutes. But actually, we have a way more interesting thing to talk about, what you've all joined us here today for, which is our interview subject and I hope soon to be friend, Eliza Victoria. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me. It's so funny. I'm just listening to you talk about heaters and thermostats. I have to say, coming from a tropical country, coming to a hot country like Australia, I'm currently in Sydney. I'm like, what are those? What are heaters? What?
So you have a heating system in your home? Okay. Like, you're not trying to cool things down constantly? That's very odd.
I know. Before we started recording, you were talking about wearing gloves inside your house. And I'm like, what?
Well, just so you know, okay, that's also weird here.
Oh, God. All right. Well, you wanted... going all over the place. Here we are. Welcome to thermostats.
This is the thermostat podcast. Yeah. We're actually going to only talk about thermostats.
Yeah. Anyway,
I hope you've got opinions.
So anyway, I am Eliza Victoria, thermostat expert. All right. I write horror, science fiction, fantasy, and everything in between. I am, like I said, originally from the Philippines. I moved to Sydney in 2018, and I'm still here. Especially when the pandemic happened, I'm like, well, I guess I'm staying.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I'm so happy to be here. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, we're so excited. I have After Limbana just sitting right in front of me, and it is so pretty. I just want to talk about it. But yeah, I have a few questions because I don't know what order anything came out in. I know that After Limbana was something that you worked on for a long time. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's true. So I guess talking about the origins of the comic book. So before After Limbana came out, I already had three titles under my belt. I have a short story collection, a science fiction novel, and another dark fantasy novel. And I was at a comic book convention in Manila, and I have my books displayed in front of me. I have like a time slot for signing, and I can see people going by my table, and they'll be, you know, sort of excited looking at the covers of those titles and flicking through the books. And then seeing the look of disappointment pass over their faces when they realize it's prose and not graphic novels. And so I was just like sitting at the table being like, oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
And then just sort of realizing that there's a huge segment of the Filipino reading public, I guess, that doesn't access my stories just because they don't read prose or are not interested in reading prose, or they're, you know, just wanting to just read more comic books. And the Philippines has a very strong comic book community. a lot of artists that just do it DIY sort of thing. Like they print it themselves, they photocopy it, sell it at the tables in comic book conventions. Later on, they find publishers and then, yeah, and then enjoy sales from that. And then I thought, I mean, I love reading comic books. And I never tried writing one. So I just put it as like a challenge for myself, I guess. Maybe I'll write one, especially after that experience where I was like, well, just you wait, you know, maybe I'll come out with a title. So I started after Lambana actually started as like this weird list of magical diseases that I was just working on. That's like, I don't even know if I was thinking of publishing that list, to be honest. It's just, I guess, just a writing exercise. Mm-hmm. And then later on, I was like, I wonder what will happen if I follow someone who's sick with one of these illnesses. And that's where it started. I just, before writing fiction, I was reading a lot. Just I read everything I can get my hands on. So it just followed that before starting to write the comic book script, I would read comic book scripts.
Yeah.
So I just found scripts online, and there was an edition of Marvel 1602 written by Neil Gaiman that came with the script, or not the whole script, but just a bit of it, like a few pages.
Right, and the part of the afterword, right? Like they just kind of tag it on at the end of the book, from what I remember.
Yeah, true. So with his notes and all that, I would read film scripts. So I just sort of learned the language. Like, my bachelor's degree is in journalism, and I also took film classes, so film electives. So I sort of knew, you know, medium shot, long shot, close up, that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. That's that kind of language in script writing. So I used that, and I reached out to Mervin, whom I knew from his series Tabipo, which is available online at the time. Like, he hasn't published it yet in paperback. So I just knew him from his art, and it just looked amazing. So I was just thinking, oh, you know, like I'll pitch it to him and see if he's willing to work with me. And when I pitched it to him, I already had the full script. Like, it's all written out. And I was like, if he said no, well, I guess I'll just move on and find someone who can work with me, because I can't draw myself to save myself, I guess. Yeah, not my skill set. Yeah, so I pitched it to him, and he was excited to draw urban landscapes, because Tabipo is mainly set in, the setting is rural, so it's a lot of like farmlands and fields, and he's like, oh, now I can draw buildings.
Yes.
and graffiti, and you know.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say, is he wrote a really nice afterword.
Yes.
For like that is in the back matter, that's lovely. And I was gonna say, I feel like you're kind of underselling, because what he said is that his comic had sort of taken off, and he got a bunch of people asking him to work with him on scripts, but he chose you. So I'm just gonna say,
okay,
that feels significant. Yeah, the afterwards nice. And then that was one of the big things he spoke about, was like, oh, it was so fun to draw cars and graffiti. Yes. And buildings. So I was like, oh my gosh,
isn't it so wonderful when you read a comic book that has a city that looks like it's being lived in, like it looks like a city that's real.
Yes.
And that you can almost touch, like the graffiti on the wall, you know, like there's, it's just like, I grew up reading, you know, superhero comics and stuff. And I used to think that New York looked like a Spider-Man comic. And then you like look at New York and you're like, oh yeah, there's so much else going on here. That was one of the things I actually did want to ask about, because there is such a connection to the scenery in this. And so I just wanted to know, was that a conversation between the two of you? Like, were you were you engaging with the scenery on the same level that the art was?
Yes. Yeah, so when I pitched it to him, and he said yes, and I was like, here you go. Here's the whole story. Yeah, so it's a full script. And I think he also mentioned it in the afterword that it's written like a film script. So it's everything, camera angles, what the background is going to look like, it's all written in my script. So even like the texture of the city, I wrote in there, like, even what the graffiti is going to say.
Oh.
So it's like, it's, you know, based on the Manila that we know. Mm-hmm. Because when I was writing the script, I was already working in the city. I grew up in the province, so not in the city, like in the rural area. So I'm more familiar with, you know, the farmlands that Mervin is sort of at this point sick of drawing. I guess that's one of the pleasures of working in this medium, because I've been writing fiction before working on the After Lambana script. And in my head, I mean, I write in English, and that's fraught with colonialism, you know? Mm-hmm. I'm Filipino writing in English, so that's always going to come with its own baggage, which I guess is a whole nother discussion. But yeah, so I write in English, but in my head, it's all Filipino characters. Most of my settings is in the Philippines. Even if it's not set in the Philippines, for example, if I write a story set in Bangkok, Thailand, for example, the POV character is Filipino. And I'm not sure at times if that comes across. Like the novel that came before After Lambana is called Dwellers, which won the Philippine National Book Award. Some people come to me and say, because I don't say the name of the city, you know, like I don't give, cultural markers. Like I don't name the university that the characters go to, the streets that they walk down on. But in my head, you know, it's the Philippines. But some people, they'd come to me and be like, oh, imagine it as like anywhere, any place, you know,
yeah.
Which frustrates me sometimes, because I'm like, I can't describe every little thing, you know, and be like, this is the Philippines,
yeah.
And this is the Filipino writing this yeah. freaking story, you know. but with the comic book medium and working with an artist, you have the texture, you have that visual already, and so I don't need to, like, it's undoubtedly a Filipino comic book, even if it's written in English, and even if the characters are speaking in English. Yeah, so I guess, yeah, that's why, it's a delight, you know? Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I was, that reminds me of a conversation I've seen a lot of people talking about, which is sometimes, you know, and I'm going to talk about white authors specifically, a lot of white authors will not describe the race of characters or only describe the race of characters who they think are
other.
Different,
yeah.
Which is like, who are you describing then?
Yeah, I know.
And the thing is, right, like a lot of white readers, we put ourselves
yes.
into these narratives. And so we project like, oh, this is a white person. Oh, in a white environment.
Mm-hmm.
And so that tension is tough. But I think that's what's so exciting, like you were saying about the comic form, is
yeah.
this is undeniable. This isn't London. This isn't
yes.
New York. This
isn't exactly.
L.A., you know, like
yeah.
this is Manila, and you can see that, and
yes.
it's visceral. Like, I love knowing that you described the texture of the walls.
Mm.
I was like, oh my God, of course you did. Of course you did, because it's just oozing. And that's so fun. You know, I'd love to hear a little bit about what it was like getting back some of those early drawings from Mervin of characters, of settings, and like how that felt for you as a creator.
Yeah, it's really exciting, because just as a fictionist and poet, just working with language, you know, what the picture I have in my head is different from the picture the reader will have in their heads, and I have no control over that, and I shouldn't, you know. It's like a collaboration with the reader, whereas you have the comic book, and what you see is what you get, and that is a different experience for me. It's funny also. Just the difference between the media that we work with fiction, you can't really quote-unquote hide things in the background, because the moment you write about something, it's in the spotlight, you know? Like, you
can't write?
Like, you can't write, it's hard to write a jump scare in a horror novel. But now that when we were working on the comic book, it's like, you can add like little Easter eggs. Mervin peppered this comic book with, you know, things that are important to him. I think like his cat is on the cover. Like, you'll see it like on the like missing cat.
Oh yeah.
Something like
that. I was gonna ask about the missing cat poster.
Yeah.
That's so cute. Oh, I'm so happy to know that.
and there would be like Easter eggs from his own comic book series. So that's the part that's exciting to me. Yeah. And then when he talked about his plan about, you know, how it's going to be colored. Yeah, it's just so cool. But I also feel for the artist because, you know, like the writer can like write one line and be like, I was walking down the street and there's a lot of people there. And he's like, oh, fuck, no, I need to write. I need to draw a crowd. There's a lot of work.
It makes you really appreciate like an animated series when like the crowd is still. It's like, I get why.
Yes. It's so hard to do. Yeah. So that's always been fun. It's funny. Going on a tangent again. Because I also write, I wrote one act plays that were staged in Manila. And just thinking about, because I write in English and characters are speaking in English. But it's strange when I started writing one act plays and I imagined myself, because as a writer, you would join the rehearsals and, you know, give your insights and all that. And just imagining myself sitting in an auditorium, watching people on stage, saying my words, and I can't imagine them speaking in English for some reason. Like that. So I was like, I can't write this one act play in English. So they have to be speaking Filipino. And that's still something that I'm sort of figuring out why that is. Like anything performed in real time in the same space as myself, I can't imagine them speaking English. Whereas if it's in a short story or in this comic book, I'm totally fine with it, thinking that it's all in translation, you know? It's just strange.
It is. And I think it raises a really interesting idea, which is like, tell me if I'm being too heady, y'all.
No.
I'm kind of like a fan of the idea of like all creation is translation.
Yes.
Because it never matches exactly what's in my head, because what's in my head is full of, you know, lies I tell myself and millions of other things that like, you know, logical fallacies I walk through my day, you know?
Yeah.
And so it's interesting thinking about writing in multiple languages, writing in English as a person who I'm guessing it's not your first language.
No.
And so I'm curious there, like, are there things that you, like, there were a few times in After Lambana that people spoke, I'm not sure what language it was, to be honest, but like there was like a couple of words that weren't in English. And I'm curious, when are those moments? Like, when do you feel like there's a need to bring in that multilingual piece? And yeah, I guess I just also am like, what's it like writing in English? Like, tell me about the whole experience, because I'm sure it's a little bit weird and a little bit fun, maybe.
Yeah, so I guess I can start with how I started my reading life in English, because my parents bought, like, when I was really young, a full set of encyclopedia and Harvard classics, you know, some Shakespeare and all that. And I remember flicking through the pages, and this is me like really like maybe 6 or 7 years old and getting frustrated because I can't understand the language. And then suddenly, you know, learning English and everything clicks into place, and it's like, I remember that moment really clearly. I don't remember much about my childhood, you know, like growing older, just losing memories. And but I remember that moment clearly because it's like magic. Because one moment I don't understand what's on the page, and then suddenly I like the world opens up, you know. I have to say though, English is the language of business in the Philippines. It still has that, I guess, weird connotation of if you speak English, you're well educated. And that's where my parents are also coming from. Like, this will give you economic advancement. So that's, I guess, why I started reading in English and then later on writing in English and having that dream of being published in English. Which, is that right or wrong? I mean, up to now, it's still a struggle with me. Like, why am I not writing in Filipino? Although I did write those one act plays in Filipino because I can't think of any other way to write them. So as to deciding when to have those multilingual moments in stories, sometimes there are moments when you can't just translate an emotion, or it's more than a word, more than just the word that you're using. You can't just translate an emotion perfectly. So I have to switch to my first language, which is Filipino. Yeah. And it's also like a friendly wave to a Filipino reader, I guess. Reading the story, being like, oh, there you go. Yeah, I understand it completely. Yeah. But as for if you're asking for like structural rules, I have no idea. Sometimes I don't know. Sometimes it's just, oh, it feels right to put that here.
No, it's just, that's what I was going to guess, is that there are just these moments where it's like, oh, that's what needs to be there.
Yeah.
I don't know what to say. I find that it's always funny talking to creatives because to some degree, we're all kind of, I don't know, like we're making up some of the stuff, right?
Because
like, I don't know why I choose X, Y, Z in whatever moment exactly, but I can probably rationalize it pretty well.
It's funny because when you write about what you're doing, I mean, I went to grad school, so you have to do something like that. Like you have the creative work and then you need to write your exegesis and explain where this is all coming from. But I'm like, fuck if I know. I don't know. So sometimes even that part feels like a creative piece of work because you're like, all right, let's put some theory in it.
Let me apply theory to my own brain.
I know. But that's not how creative writing works. Like it doesn't, sometimes you just can't explain it.
Yeah. Isn't it fun though whenever somebody asks you something and they're like, yeah, I noticed that you like did this and that was probably tied to this other thing that you did. And you're just like, oh yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Definitely I did that on purpose. Let's go ahead and assign me the genius award today because I clearly knew the allegory I was putting into this piece of writing.
Yeah, let's add it to my canon. I didn't know I was writing in this moment.
You're talking a lot about like theory and stuff, and it's obvious we're all big readers, right? So I'm thinking too about all of the times where I'll be reading something and it's just like, you know, whatever, Virginia Woolf revisited these themes, or you know, it's like those kind of things where like they're always kind of dissecting somebody's output and you're just like, oh, I hope no one does that to me because like I don't want to know.
Didn't that happen to you recently, Sarah? Someone was like, you always deal with these themes. And you were like, shh, 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 shh.
I was like, what?
Do not tell me.
That's a surprise.
Oh, I
was like, that's
it.
Awesome of me. Like, that sounds great.
Yeah, sometimes it's all, you know, like just coming from the unconscious. Like, you're not like actively planning to just write about these themes, you know, when you start your writing career, you're like, yeah, it's just hard to explain sometimes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, totally. Yeah.
It's like hard enough to just get words on a page. Like, trust me, I don't know if I'm doing all that.
I heard that Melville was like shocked whenever people told him that Moby Dick is allegorical. And I was like,
I'm writing about this. Yeah.
Hard relate, dude. Like, yeah.
Yeah.
But of course you read it and you're like, oh yeah, the white whale, right? Like, you know, that's become such like a classically allegorical thing. But yeah, I don't know. I guess like if you just read Moby Dick as like two dudes who like are kind of flirting with each other and like a sick whale situation and like having a great time on a boat, like then that's awesome too, honestly. So it's like you don't necessarily need the theory like added to everything,
that's
but it
true.
Is fun to dive into, right?
Yeah, true. It's funny because I think in a conversation with another writer friend, I was talking about publishing as like a conversation. But the thing is, when a reader picks up your work, you're not there.
Yeah.
So it's not It's not really a conversation. You're not part of it. So, yeah. Yeah. And I guess...
You're not part of it. It's so real. It's so real.
They're closing the door on you. Like, literally, you're just like, what are you thinking? What do you think about it? Do you want to, like, talk about it? And they're, like, slowly closing the door, like, awkwardly, like... Let me just be alone with the book, okay? And you're just like, oh, okay, I guess. Text me your thoughts.
They're closing the door and being like, oh, this is about two men falling in love. And you're like, no, it's about a white whale. It's just a whale. Oh, well.
Oh, well. Oh, man, that is so funny. Okay, well, I'm going to totally do what we just made fun of. Because I want to talk about how one of the big pieces of After Lambana is the after, right? So this is a time when the Magic Prohibition Act is in place. Mm-hmm. And so the Diwata are, you know, they're on the ropes, let's say. They're being hunted, arrested, left and right. And so there's this sort of... underground feel to the whole thing. And I'm so curious, the whole graphic novel is what I mean by thing. I'm so curious, you know, what was it that was for you important about having the Magic Prohibition Act in place at the time of the book unfolding?
Yeah, so when I started writing the comic book script, I think that would be around ages ago, right? Like 2013, something like that. I mean... the Philippines is not in a good place politically, socially, financially, I guess I would say. So it's just part of my lived experience, that kind of oppression and that kind of just feeling of hopelessness and loss of control, I guess. So that's why, I mean, this is about a city populated with magical creatures, but I was just thinking, like, I wonder what it would feel like to have this magnificent creatures, I would say, transported to a place where I'm living. You know, like, how will they make rent? Like, how are they going to find a job? How are they going to deal with crime? So that's what I found important, like having that juxtaposition between something ethereal and magical and something very, well, I guess mundane, but also dangerous.
Yes. It's one of the things that I love about urban fantasy, which is the ability to go to fantastical, you know, worlds, characters, creatures, and they need a job.
Yeah.
Like, that's a real tension, right? Like, that is one of the big stressors of my life is gotta make money, right?
Yes.
And so I think that what's so cool about setting this during that time of the Prohibition Act is that for me, it feels really relevant to today while being distinctly different from. So I can get why some people are like, oh, I could see some of these things happening anywhere. Again, less so with the comic. But what I think is so, forgive me, magical about including the Magic Prohibition Act is that it reflects the world we live in. It reflects what it's like to be a person who cares about other people, who's progressive, who maybe has what I would call magical identities, being queer, trans, being any kind of minority in a system. And it gives us that sort of sense of like, oh, we're all part of something here. But what I also am obsessed with in After Lambana is like, it is tragic. There are tragic turns throughout, but it's lyrical at the same time. And I'll venture a guess. I feel like some of that is your tone. I think that's some of the way you write. I noticed that in Wounded Little Gods, that same sort of like tragedy with magic sort of mixed all together and then like presented in this very lyrical way. And I think it makes it where I can go to really intense places with the narrative because it's still stunning the whole time. Like, the guy, oh my God, the fucking opening with like, oh, do you know what happens if you're killed by a sirena? And it's like, you die standing up. And then you turn the page and it's like that guy. And you're like, whoa, this is cool.
Can I just say, I mean, that opening line, that's directly lifted from a story told to me by my mother. So I guess I forgot to mention that in the beginning, my background. So my family, my mother's family is from Cagayan Valley. This is in the northern Philippines. So rural area, you know, and there are a lot of like supernatural folk beliefs that are still around. And I grew up in a household with those beliefs. It's funny when you talk about like fantasy, speculative fiction, like there's this great divide between what is considered realistic and what's considered non-realistic or fantastical. But in my household growing up, they're one and the same. Like, that is reality. Like, having mermaids killing you and you dying standing up, that's real. That's from their stories. So from my mother's perspective, that really happened. So it's like, yeah.
I love that. I love the idea of these lines we make up, yes. Right? Of like, oh, this is speculative. Oh, this is real. This is not real. It's like, well, who really made those rules, right? Like, I think we all know it was a bunch of old white guys. Like, and they're dead. So who cares what they think?
I guess that tragic tone of just someone coming after a great age. Like, sometimes I feel that. I mean, living in the year of our Lord, 2022. As a woman and a Filipino, it just feels like I came too late for the great party, you know, like everyone's already had their fun and I'm just here trying.
Me deep.
All right, like it's just me. Here I am trying to make rent.
Yeah, you know, it reminds me of, I don't know, it was like a tweet I saw where someone was like, you know, it's just trying to survive another terrible thing that is life-changing, globe-altering, and it's just another day in 2022.
Yep.
What?
Yeah, it's funny. In Sydney, we've had, like, a lot of rain. I mean, not this week, but in previous weeks. And they would say, once in a century, rainfall, blah, blah, blah. And I was like, we've had this once in a century rainfall 3 times this year, guys. Like, what is happening? So, yeah.
Oh, yeah. That happened in my neighborhood here in Denver. There was a bunch of city planning around, like, oh, we need to be prepared for a once in a century storm. And it was like kind of feeling like, do you not have the facts I have? Because do you not know about global climate change? Because that's not going to be how it is anymore. Mm. And it already isn't how it is.
Yeah, true. Yeah.
So weird.
People are like, in the far off future,
yes,
hundreds of years from now. And we're like, no, like today, like 10 years ago,
like yesterday.
Actually. Like, can we talk about this? There's a lot of conversation about how sci-fi kind of takes like dystopian themes. And I'm like, sometimes I feel like dystopian reality is taking notes from sci-fi, though, because like you're constantly just kind of like, oh, man, this seems like not like it almost couldn't be real or something. And then it's like just kind of something that people are like so happy to just kind of put aside or something and be like, oh, not looking at that. Like global crisis is going to, like climate crisis is going to affect all of us, right? But it already is. Like it's affecting, it's going to, you know, affect different communities differently, but it's something that's already such a big deal. And it's definitely something where people are like, could we focus on like building a spaceship to Mars or something? And it's like, could we focus on like fixing anything first, like maybe? I don't know. Question mark?
Yeah.
I'll just pretend that was a question.
No, I was just thinking about that too. Because science fiction, because I also write science fiction, but I feel like science fiction in the Philippines is very, I mean, you're writing about the future, but you're very concerned with what's happening in the present.
Yeah.
Yeah, especially with all of those disasters, because the Philippines gets a lot of storms every year, and it feels like every year it's getting worse and worse, you know? And it's funny when you mentioned, you know, building a spaceship to Mars, because I was just, I've been rattling around this idea in my head, because the tropes that I guess Western science fiction is sort of over with, like robots and space programs and all that, those are the tropes that I personally embrace because it's like an act of subversion in a way. Because the Philippines is not known as like this great center of scientific development. So at least, I guess, just thinking that at least in my fiction, it can be. Like, I can imagine it as that, you know? Yeah. Anyway.
No, that's another super thought. Interesting. I was like, beep, 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 beep. 17 more questions.
Like, yeah, same. My brain was like, must upload. Apparently, I am a robot. I'm not sure. Well, we have, you know, a good friend of the pod is Stephanie Williams, and she's been on a bunch of different times. We love her, does great comics. She has been writing Nubia and has like a million things on the horizon. Yeah. I'm always like, Steph, what? How are you not? Do you sleep? And one of the things she talked about is she was like, why is it that right when people of color, Black people, Filipino people, right when we get to telling the stories, we get a chance to finally tell the stories that are tropes you've been playing with, y'all decide they're no longer cool.
Yeah.
I wonder why that is. And I'm a big believer of like, we haven't even seen the best of what genre can do.
Oh, absolutely.
The more it becomes diversified in every sense of the word, the more that we get stories that, like you were saying, like where you grew up with the discussions of the Sirena, not as like some other thing, but as quite real.
Yeah.
Those stories just make the whole world of science fiction, fantasy, and horror just so much richer.
Yeah.
And I'm personally a big fan. I'm like, yes, let's hear some different stories, some different takes. I have to say, after Limbana impressed the hell out of me, like I knew I was going to like it. You know, I'm like, oh, Myth and Magic in Manila, sign me up.
With gorgeous art.
But then I was reading it and on the art and the cover, I mean, all of it. But like, it is probably my favorite comic that I've read this year.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah, I mean, you know, no one can hold me to that because I can't think of any other comics I've read this year at the moment. But I really was, you know, reading it this week again and just like, wow, every page turn, every panel is just so rich. And so I'm a little bit curious, like, do you feel like your script was really long?
Oh, to be honest, I didn't think so. Yeah, because I also like, because this is a new challenge for me writing a comic book script, but I just to make sure that I'll finish it, I was like, I need to put another constraint on myself. So I was like, this will just happen in one night. You know, so it's just going to be this
smart, yeah.
Yeah, it's going to be this road trip just so I can actually finish this freaking thing.
I relate to that deeply.
Yeah, so I don't think it was very long. I can't remember how many I won't be able to tell you. I'll have to look through my old files.
I was just curious because you were saying, you know, you put so much description in the panels and the pages and so I can kind of, I'm like, oh wow, I wanna see the script. I'm like, Eliza.
It's funny, you know, because well, going into the script, I was primarily a fictionist. So I was like putting quote unquote craft into the descriptions. And then later on, I was like, the reader's not going to see this. Mervyn's going to see this. It has to be like understandable to the artist. Cause at some point, I think he was like, what do you mean by this? And I was being so metaphorical and all that. And I'm like, oh no.
It'll be a little bit more straightforward. You know, that's so funny to hear. Sarah and I also work on fiction podcasts. Mm. And she was reading one of my scripts and she was like, so. A bunch of the stuff that's important to the script isn't happening in audio format. It's in the script. And I was like, oh, yeah. No one's reading the script except us. Okay, good point.
Yeah, and then
it's always funny.
Yeah, and so later on in the script, I was just like, here's like a peg. Here's a visual peg for this particular panel. Here's a link to, you know, some color palettes for you. So I just made it really straightforward. In terms of, we were discussing, you know, the themes or the topics of After Lambana, talking about the overarching themes of like oppression and crime and all that. But I'm also, I mean, the main question, I guess, that propels the story is just a question about redemption. Like, how do you ask forgiveness after a great wrong, you know? When's the moment when you feel like you're forgiven? That sort of thing.
Yeah, yeah. And like, can you really fix things you've
done? Yeah. Can you really fix that? Yeah, after, yeah.
Yeah, Oh, so good. I got chills. I'm like, oh God, you're right. That is what it is about.
Yes, I mean, it has all of the good stuff, you know, but it's also primarily a very human story. Like, the story of redemption is, that's always been, I guess, a preoccupation with me. Human interaction and all that, no matter how fantastical the stories become, it always comes down to that, yeah.
Yeah, because, you know, and tell me where I'm wrong, but it seems to me like part of the human condition is hurting each other.
Yeah.
And in more or less malicious ways, right? Mm-hmm. Like you can intentionally hurt people and accidentally and sometimes both, right? And I think that is what makes it so rich is like that twist I was telling you before we started recording, that twist. And I was like, oh, no. It was so delightful on the page. And it really did make me think about those questions of what does it mean to make up for something terrible you've done? Yeah. And can you?
Yeah, that's true. And it's just coming from, you know, this one character who's like, who does something in the moment because they want something right away. And then suddenly being faced with the consequences of that action down the line and being horrified by it. And then, yeah, and it's just their journey of now what? Now what's next? Yeah.
Well, and I think that's something that I felt was really different in After Lambana. Mm. And not than everything, but then in a lot of narratives we read around redemption where it's like, oh, they had a reason for doing what they did, so it's okay. And in this, it's like, they had a reason, and they should have been a lot more patient.
Yeah.
Because that actually didn't solve the problems at all. Yeah. And I loved that. I love when a character makes a mistake and is so sure of it, right until the second they aren't, you know?
Yeah.
They're like, oh, shit, that wasn't the right call.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's really beautiful. And I don't know, it's nice to really see, honestly, like male characters being apologetic, being remorseful, like not just like, I was right and I'm always right. You know, like, that was really cool too.
Aw, thanks.
Been talking on this podcast. You know, me. So I'm asking once again, the Bernie Sanders meme. I'm asking once again to rate. I am asking once again to review. Rate and review our podcast, which, you know, if you're still listening, I'm hoping that you're having a good time. If you're arguing with us in your apartment, that's okay, because sometimes I listen to podcasts to argue with them in my apartment by myself in the audience of my cats, too. Perhaps I've said too much, but if you, oh, I don't have anywhere to go after this other than go ahead and rate and review, won't you? Is it time to talk about Wounded Little Gods? Are we there?
Yes, we have to before we close. That's out. Right. We must. Yeah,
I mean, this one just came out. So I just kind of wanted to talk a little bit about, I mean, just, right? It was out in May, I believe. But, you know, new to me. And so I just kind of wanted to talk a little bit about the process of writing this book.
So Wounded Little Gods and After Lambana came out at this, the same year in the Philippines. And just because of the nature of comic book collaboration, it took longer for After Lambana to go into production. So it was written first, but they just ended up being published the same year, 2016. And then they were later on picked up by Tuttle for international publication. So when, right before Wounded Little Gods, I was talking about Dwellers. So that's the book that came out before this. And Dwellers was primarily set in the city. And I just have this thing where I'm like, okay, I wrote the book in an urban area. And I'm like, now I need to go to the province. So Wounded Little Gods is primarily set in the province. And it's the town is called Heridos. It's based on the town, my hometown, you know, where I grew up. And I think I put more of myself in the character Regina than in the other characters that I've written about. Like, we share the same background about, you know, her father working abroad and the parents, like, owning a store in the market, that sort of thing. And I guess for this project, I was thinking of, like, combining elements of sci-fi, because One of the Little Gods talks about questionable medical experiments, but also a bit of fantasy, because it features gods and goddesses from the Tagalog pantheon, which people don't know much about anymore. We always say that even Filipinos know more about Greek and Roman gods than our own ancient gods and goddesses. So I thought it'd just be interesting to sort of bring them back to life in a story that is and can be entertaining. At the same time, thought-provoking, I guess. Yeah.
I just love the voice in this book so, so much. So it's just like, I don't know, like, where is it? Okay, yeah, no, it's like from the first paragraph where it's like, okay, there's, you know, spirits used to roam the town of Eridos. And then there's like a little bit of description. And then it's like, well, we already know this. She knows this, but she needs to stay awake. So from the top. And I was like, oh my God, that's exactly what I want to hear is like, This woman who's just like, I am going to stay conscious, you know, like, I am going to get through this. And she keeps that energy going. It's just, it's a really fun read. I found it very, I'm still reading it as I share, but I'm finding it very like quickly paced and just also lyrical. Mm. So it also is, you know, I how to put it, like I sit in the moment with each piece because it's like the words are so amazing. Fun. I don't know. I guess we're at the point of the podcast where I'm just going to like compliment you a lot because I'm like obsessed.
I love it. My favorite part.
You're like, and this is the part I was waiting for.
I'm like, what you don't know is we have this part even when you're not here.
Yeah, I guess about the tone. So it's, the character is again, like, shares the same background as myself because I grew up in the province. And then like most young adults in the Philippines, like you live in the province, there's not a lot of opportunities there. So you go to university in the city where they all are. They're just all there. So I guess in a way you have no choice if you want to, earn more money, make your way out in the world. So same thing, like my life was split between the province and the city, and the voice is just of someone who's just sort of exhausted already. Like, this person is just starting her career, but she's also like very jaded and just over it all. So yeah, I guess that's where the tone is coming from. Just someone snarky and just
world weary, like she's fucking over it. She's not putting up with your bullshit. I mean, especially in like a female protagonist, that is like everything I'm looking for. You know what I mean? Like, it's just so fun. I love how like she's just like annoyed. She's just like, ugh, everyone is. Ugh.
Yeah.
And I'm like, you know what? I've been on Twitter today and I feel the same way.
Yeah, so just someone, I did have fun writing this character because Regina is, you know, headstrong and she sticks to her values, which is, I can say that about myself most days. Yeah, but she's like, this is wrong and, you know, we need to make things right. And even when she's facing like, because it features like gods and goddesses, as I've mentioned earlier, she's facing like entities of great power, but she's also just like, I'm over it.
That cover where she's just pointing, and I'm like, she's gonna kick someone's ass. Like, I'm ready for it.
Yeah, and I guess just thinking about One of the Little Gods in relation to After Lambano, because After Lambano you have male friendship, and in One of the Little Gods I just wanted to show female friendship, you know? And friendship, I think, is not a topic that most beginning writers think about. Like, maybe they go straight to romance and all that. But I've always been fascinated with stories of friendship and how even friends hurt each other, you know? So, yeah.
I love stories about friendship. I think it's so nice because it really is anything, like something that anybody can read, right? Like, everybody has friends, even if you don't have romantic partners or don't want them, you know? And I think that makes it so fun. It just is like, there's something to bite into, I guess, is the way that I would put it. Yeah, Regina's a trip. I love her. I love how pissed off she is. I'm like, yeah, samesies. In comparison to like Conrad over in After Lambana, who's kind of like resigned about like what's happening. And he's like, well, I guess that's just the way it is. She's like, fuck you. You know? So it's really fun.
True.
Yeah. Hey, relatable, right? So we've talked, oh my gosh, we've talked so much. We talked about obviously both these works that are so cool. Now I have to go read Dwellers. I'm so excited for that. You know, we've talked about working in different media and including playwriting, working in multiple languages. I'm curious, I as you both know, my dogs are being a little bit of jerks because the time change, but I wanted to ask, if we haven't, if you could talk just a little bit about your creative process, like how like do you just force words out? Do you have like a sometimes are you inspired and you're like, this book just poured out of me? I don't know. Just like generally talk to me about your creative process.
Yeah, I guess the process of creating the work differs per book. Like I would say Dwellers sort of feels like it wrote itself, like from conception to the final piece that came out, it was exactly the way I wanted, I guess. That's not always the case. Most times it's like pulling teeth. What I always say is I don't start anything unless I know how it's going to end. Like, no matter how vague the ending is, I need to know where I'm going. And I think it also helps me clarify if I have enough of a story or if maybe I need to think more about it. I need to go back to the drawing board and all that. And then I spend a really long time on the first few paragraphs. Like, I feel like, so now I have a premise. I know the ending, presumably. And now I need to nail the opening. And yeah, so I sometimes spend like, just weeks agonizing over that first page. And then once that feels right, I feel like it's smooth sailing after that. There would be moments of, like, I just run into a wall and I don't know what to do. I usually just step back and, like, watch a movie or read another, you know, consume another person's story. And maybe that will loosen something up in myself creatively, and that's when I can go back to writing it. I have to say, though, that my creative process really got disrupted during the pandemic. So I'm working currently on a horror novel, but I feel like I've been wrestling with it for a really long time just because of everything that's been happening. Mm-hmm. But now I feel like I'm back in the groove and it's enjoyable again. I feel like from 2020 onwards, just dealing with the global health crisis and all that, just all of that disruption and uncertainty, writing felt like another chore to take off. So it lost its pleasure for a moment there. But then I feel like I've gotten it back, and hopefully it won't leave anytime soon. It's funny because you know, we have this language about essential, non-essential people or occupations or tasks, and I feel like when the pandemic started, writing fell under the non-essential column, you know, in my mind. But later on I realized, you know what, yeah, it's making me happy, actually. So it's actually essential. Like, I actually need to write in order to move forward. So that's moved on now to the essential column. And I'm writing again and enjoying it. So, yeah.
That's kind of the thing about the essential, non-essential, right, is that you have this, I think, honestly, perhaps our entire society has this idea that art is kind of like a non-essential or kind of like elite, or, you know, all of these like misconceptions of what purpose it actually serves. But the whole time, you know, even in the times that I was less creative, you know, because there was, to me, this feeling of people are a little bit shittier than I thought they were, right? Because like here people were making like a huge deal out of like just wearing a mask, you know, you know, just basic things that you could do to kind of like help other people was something that people were just like not doing, and they were like fighting doing it. And so I think when it's like that, it's easy to be like, people suck, you know, and just have fun with it. And then it's like, what makes me believe in people again and again and again? And literally it's interacting with people, of course, having the people who you like know are not out here creating intentional harm. But then you have art just telling you, you know, like either if it's you, then you get to kind of play around with it and create this world where it can just be whatever you want it to be. And then if you are reading something else, even things that are like overall pretty bleak, it can really distract you from the feelings of, you know, like kind of hopelessness and you know, we're like losing so many people and like nobody is doing anything to stop it. And the people who are doing something to stop it, like they're trying so hard and people aren't listening to them. And, you know, all of those kind of bleak things. And then like you read a story about, you know, something that has nothing to do with that. And it can really be like, yeah, just something that like alleviates a lot of the stress, I think. Yeah. So I think I understand what you're saying, where it's just like, It is essential because this is like the land of dreams, right? It's like what you need to survive.
Yeah. And just, and it can be fun. And I think that's what I lost during that time, just worrying about what you need like in the moment, you know, like you need urgently. It's funny because I remember, so just being like in a dark place and then reading an interview with this Australian author named Tegan Daylight, which is an amazing name, right? So it's an interview with her. It's an old interview and she's talking about her writing process and working on a work of fiction. And then she's saying in the interview, when I reread this part, I remember just having fun, you know, with this dialogue or with the way I described this thing. And I was like, oh, yeah, I used to feel like that. I should go back to that. Like, yeah, this is fun. I guess because I get asked this also, like a message to, you know, young writers, people who are just starting to maybe their writing career or trying their hand in writing short stories and all that. It's fun, you know? If it's not fun, what's the point?
You're never gonna make it if you're not having fun with it, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Like you get to a place where you just, it has to be something that you're doing very much for yourself. I think we talked about that a little bit. We did an interview with Carmen Maria Machado where she was like, mostly there's like going to be a part of you that's just writing to you. And like, that's good. Like embrace that basically. Very much paraphrasing. People can go back and listen to that to hear what Carmen Maria Machado actually said, as opposed to what I have decided Carmen Maria Machado said, which is often not the same thing that was intended.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, writing in this genres and setting it in the Philippines, you know, I'm writing in English. I could have just written about Americans in the US and maybe sell more. I don't know. But the thing is, I am writing this to myself and also to my younger self, I guess. Like, these are titles that the younger me wasn't really able to find in the bookstores or even in the secondhand bookshops that I go to, because that's all my allowance can cover, you know. So I am writing for myself, and I guess the point of publishing them, I mean, I can just write them literally just for myself and just keep them in a drawer in my desk, but the point of publishing them is just adding to that conversation in the science fiction, as a, you know, science fiction fantasy community, that there's this other voice that can, you know, take part in the dialogue this other experience that maybe not a lot of people are aware of. So,
well, I, for one, am very glad that even though you are writing for yourself, you publish, because these books, I love them. Yeah. I love them so much. They're very dear to me.
Thank you.
Yeah, I mean, I'd love to hear what you have going on, what kind of we can look forward to in the future. And I also was curious, because you've done so many works across different mediums, is there a medium that you haven't tried that you would like to try?
Oh, great question. I guess what I have going on, so I am, I've mentioned previously, working on a horror novel now. I do want to finish the first draft, at least, I don't know. I mean, it's already November, right? I was saying, this year, I want to finish it this year. So we'll see in the next few weeks if I can finish it. Yeah. So that's what I'm working on. I'm very excited about it. I do feel that I'm growing as a writer. And I think this is maybe my strongest story yet. So I'm excited to be able to, well, first finish it and then share it with everyone.
You have to come back. We love horror. So you'll have to come back to the pod. We can't wait to talk about it.
Oh, yeah. I'd love to. Yeah, yeah. So as for other mediums, I would love to, because I, right now, I mean, like most everyone, right? Just watching a lot of shows and movies, like maybe, yeah, something like that, like write something for film or a TV show. That'd be quite interesting, I think. Yeah.
I want that very much. So, your universe, Eliza's ready. We're all ready. Let's do this. Oh my goodness. Eliza, this has been just delightful. You are so funny. Like, my stomach hurts from laughing so hard. You know, you have such wonderful stories. We are so, so pleased to have you here today. Listeners, make sure you check out both Wounded Little Gods and After Lambana. We will have links to both in the show notes. So if you didn't have a chance to write those down, no worries. Just hit the three little dots and we will share that. Eliza, we will also share any social media and website handles you have. But did you want to share any of those now? Do you want folks to follow you on social or anything?
Oh, yeah, sure. You can just visit elizavictoria.com. It has links to everything else. Like,
brilliant.
Yeah, it's all there.
Hey, that makes my life easier when I go put those show notes together.
Yeah.
So if you didn't have a pen, listeners, we will have a link to Eliza's website as well. And from there, you can go find where she's at on social. Sarah, thank you as always. You're a delight. Kate, thank you for making us sound great. Patrons, listeners, we could be here without you, but that'd be so strange. So thank you so much for being here with us. And again, Eliza, I just can't thank you enough. This has been the highlight of my day, very easily.
Aw, thank you so much.
Thank you for listening to Bitches on Comics. We are a bi-weekly podcast where we talk to your favorite comics and pop culture creators and critics about what matters to them in comics and pop culture, as you might have guessed. You can follow us on Twitter at Bitches on Comics and on Instagram at Bitches on Comics. Our website is, brace yourself, bitchesoncomics.com. If you go there, you can listen to any of our episodes, and we've got other shit that we put on tabs. I don't remember what it is. I am in charge of updating the website, however, so good luck.
Thanks for the heads up. I'll go to this website now. If you'd like to support the podcast, you can do so by rating and reviewing us on iTunes, Spotify, or Stitcher, or wherever you listen to podcasts. I'm Sarah Century, and you can find me at www.sarahcentury.com. and Twitter and Instagram. Still Sarah Century on those.
I'm Essie Fleenor. You can learn more about me at essiefleenor.com. You can find me on Twitter and Instagram at @SE_Fleenor.
Bitches on Comics is recorded by Kate Warner, who plays in the band Church Fire. You can find them at churchfiremusic.com. Our music is recorded by Katie Taylor, who plays as Earth Control Pill. You can find her music at earthcontrolpill.bandcamp.com.
Bitches on Comics is recorded in Denver, Colorado. We want to recognize the indigenous peoples who have inhabited and do inhabit this land. The Arapaho Nation, the Ute Nation, the Cheyenne Nation, and others who have been erased from our history and collective memories through colonization.